Good morning, everybody. It's 9 o'clock, and Philip is away preaching up in Tennessee, I believe. So you are stuck with me twice, and we have a lovely opportunity to hear Terry preach this morning as well. Let's begin with a prayer. Father, you are so very good to us. We thank you for your care, and we thank you for the way in which you have planned all these things. As we look deeper into Leviticus this morning, help us to appreciate the holiness with which you require your people to approach you. Help us to see the way in which our lives need to be holy. Since we live with you constantly, every day. We thank you so very much for Jesus who has made this possible. And our desire to grow closer to you and to each other. In Jesus' name. Amen. All right, Leviticus. We've been talking about leprosy. Leprosy, as it relates to not just the body. We talked about the fact that this term leprosy is a general term for any type of disease that related to somebody's skin. And today, when the next chapter we look at, chapter 13, we're going to notice that this also related to something besides your body. They use the same term in reference to what? A house, of all things, where you're living. So let's look at that, and then we'll look at some of the ways in which God specified that they cleanse it and the reasons behind that. All right. Well, we're just going to start with chapter 14. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "This shall be the law." What happened in Leviticus 10 that initiated this part of Leviticus and talking about all these specific ways in which people needed to be clean before they approached God, and the way in which they approached God, the specialness, the holiness of the way in which they worshiped God. Do you remember that significant event? All right, Aaron's sons, the very priests that were charged not just in worshiping God for themselves, but they're representing the rest of the nation approaching God. And they did that in a profane way, an unholy way, in a way that was not special. And so, right on the heels of that, in God, through Moses, helping Aaron to see how important it was for him not to see it from a personal vantage point where he was sad about his sons dying, but to rather, in his position as high priest, to see the violation of the boundaries that God has set up between he and his people. This is not an idol that they were approaching. This is the physical, actual representative, the presence of God. And so as God, they could even see his presence there in the smoke and the fire in the tent of meeting here. And so it was very important. How important do you think it was to Aaron? Sorry, we're in Leviticus chapter 14 today. as it relates to all these different things. So if God is now delineating how it is that people approach God and approach this idea of being holy versus not holy, common, or being clean versus unclean, is this going to be important to the rest of the people, especially to the priests? Yes. All right, so keep that in the back of your minds. And as we looked at last Wednesday night, God doesn't always give the explanation of why He sets out for things to be considered unholy versus holy, or clean versus unclean. But the mere fact that He states that it is, and He gives the remedy for that, how to make that now appropriate, is something that we need to take on board. We talked about last time the fact that it wasn't always a moral reason. They were normal, natural, everyday things that God created our bodies to work. And so don't always associate, in fact, try not to associate the difference between clean and unclean with being right and wrong. In English, especially as we've inherited this idea through the Catholic idea of holiness and their rites, we have tended to associate something that is not holy with something that's wrong. And we'll use the English words unholy. How many of us, when we hear the word unholy, we think bad? Right? We start associating that with satanic and the occult and something that is so opposite to God. But that's not what those words meant. Unholy just meant not special. It was your ordinary, regular, everyday, run-of-the-mill sort of things, activities that we did. And whether it was childbirth that we talked about last time, or we're going to talk about disease today, and as well, we're going to actually talking about procreation in chapter 15 here. All of these reasons for bodily fluids to escape the normal and the rightful boundary that God set up, our skin, required something to be done before that person was, in God's view, an appropriate subject to approach Him in holiness. Less.
In our day, I think it would be compared more to approaching God with reverence. Approaching everyday, like people say things in an everyday manner about God, like talking about the man upstairs, and we approach him with reverence and not with terms like that. I think that would be probably a comparison of today of what he's talking about here, the way they approach God, the way he's accepted with him, and then they approach him with reverence. Say,
okay.
God is just a common person, a common thing.
All right. That would be an application as we are now looking, we're moving from how the Israelites and how God set things up with them, as we're trying to see how to apply that to our lives and our relationship with God. And I appreciate you bringing up those examples here. And that is part of why we're looking at Leviticus. We're not Jewish, but the idea of understanding that dynamic of clean and unclean to the purpose of getting to the point where we are approaching God as the Israelites were in holiness. Because as we looked at those two dynamics, clean versus unclean and holy versus common, the whole point was so that you didn't ever possibly have that chance where you were unclean and you would jump the boundary to try to be serving God directly when you were supposed to be holy. You had to take care of that uncleanness, become clean, to now be common, to now jump to preparing yourself physically as well as mentally to approach God's physical presence. All right, there's a difference here because we're now talking about the tent of meeting where God physically was. The type of ground that was holy, where he would, in other places, tell the person that was approaching them to take their shoes off. Is it sinful to wear shoes? No. It's a necessary, regular, ordinary thing to do. But to God, he wanted to impress on them that this was special. All right. So, as Les was referring, as we interact with God today, is there a rule that we need to take our shoes off before worshiping God? No. But what does the New Testament talk about? Okay. All right. So the idea of trying to approach God, and I'm not talking just about our assemblies. I'm talking about approaching God throughout our week. We do that in a way in which is now spiritually based with our mind, and the continual echoes bouncing back between Leviticus and Romans here as these two classes are interacting is just fantastic. As we're approaching God in our relationship with Him, we're also having this dynamic of clean versus unclean. But now, it's not the circumcision of our flesh, but the circumcision of what? Our heart, all right? I'm going like this accommodatively, but you understand what I'm referring to, right? Our heart, our mind. And in Romans 7 that we're going to talk about today, that was so key to the dynamic that Paul is trying to get the Christians who are from Jewish extraction here that are very familiar with these laws in Leviticus to understand the difference in the dynamic of serving God with our mind and dealing with actually existing in the flesh. All right, so with that in mind, let's continue on. This shall be the law. He says that in each of these categories, and at the end, he kind of gives it a summing up. This is a leprous person who has been cleansed, all right? Somebody who has been determined, you are clean, you're healing, and now this is how you go about changing your category, your status of being unclean as it relates to God, to being clean. He shall be brought to the priest, and the priest shall go out of the camp, and the priest shall look. And if the case of the leprous disease is healed in the leprous person, the priest shall command them to take for him who is to be cleansed two live clean birds and cedar wood or hyssop, and scarlet yarn and hyssop. And the priest shall command them to kill one of the birds in an earthenware vessel over fresh water. I can tell you, it doesn't explain it anywhere in the old law why all of these details. Why do you take two birds? Why do they have to be live to begin with? Why does he take them with him to the house? Why does he put it in a pottery jar? Why does he kill it over live water? So he's got to find a creek or a river or something where the water's flowing and kill it there. The earthenware vessel collect the blood, and then he go through this next ritual. He shall take the live bird with the cedar wood and the scarlet yarn and the hyssop and dip them and the live bird in the blood of the bird that was killed over the fresh water. So all these accessories to this process here, The priest has to then, after he kills one of the birds, dip each of these into the blood of this dead bird inside the jar. And he shall sprinkle it 7 times on him who is to be cleansed of the leprous disease. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Then he shall pronounce him clean and shall let the living bird, remember he was dipped in the water, he's dipped in the blood, he shall let it go in the open field. So he's got to go outside of the city and let it go. Una paloma blanca. And when he who is clean shall wash his and he who is to be cleansed shall wash his clothes and shave off all the hair and bathe himself in water, and he shall be clean. So it's been normal as we've been looking through these different categories that whatever happens, if it was a regular, ordinary, run-of-the-mill way in which you became unclean, that you would wash your body and many times wash your clothes, and you would still remain unclean until the end of the day. And at that evening when the new day started, you would then be ceremonially clean. And you could approach other people who were clean without contaminating them ceremonially. And more importantly, you could then go to the tent of meeting and worship the physical presence of God in the tabernacle. But here's something even beyond that. What else did they have to do? Something I forgot to do. They had to shave all the hair off of their body, including their eyebrows. A little extreme, right? Does it say here that it's for health reasons? No, it doesn't. Now, if you've got a skin disease, might that help? I'm not going to comment on that. But it doesn't say that that's the reason behind. So let's be careful not to add reasonings when the Bible doesn't specify that. And of course, as we come back to the comment before, as we are trying to see through the same eyes and apply these principles to our own lives today, let's take this with a certain amount of deference and realizing there are some areas that God chose not to reveal, and yet still required obedience. And we have that same dynamic. So after that, he can come into the camp, but live outside his tent 7 days. Remember, where are they living right now? Leviticus was given to them in the wilderness. All right? They're still at Mount Sinai. They're still camped here in their tribes. And outside of the camp is where you had to be if you were unclean. And once you've been pronounced clean, you can come in after this initial sacrifice process here. But you can't go into your tent with the rest of the people, with the rest of your home as normal. You had to wait for 7 days. And if you didn't lapse back into your leprosy, on the 8th day, you shall take 2 male lambs without blemish and 1 ewe lamb a year old without blemish. All these birds and animals that were clean themselves ceremonially and were without problems themselves, all right? They had to be whole. And a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah with a fine flour mixed with oil and an additional amount of oil. And the priest who cleanses him shall set the man who is to be cleansed and these things before the Lord at the entrance of the tent. So after he comes back, those next 7 days, he can be in the camp with everybody and he's not going to contaminate anyone. But he is not yet available ceremonially to approach God. So after those 7 days, he's now then brought from his tent to the center of camp where the tent of meeting is, where God's presence is, and he's now being presented to God. And they shall kill the lamb in place where they kill the sin offering and the burnt offering, okay, the altar where they would kill all the different sacrifices. For the guilt offering, like the sin offering, belongs to the priest. It is most holy. The priest shall then take some of the blood of the guilt offering, and the priest shall put it on the lobe of the right ear. Anybody know where the lobe is on your ear? Who is to be cleansed, and on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot. Man, this seems arcane and almost silly. And when you read it by yourself, it may cause you to chuckle. What in the world? But was this a laughing matter to the Israelites? No, sir. No. The priest will take some of the container of oil and pour it into the palm of his own left hand, and dip his right finger in the oil that is in his left hand, and sprinkle oil with his finger 7 times before the Lord. All right, not on the person, just before God. And some of the oil that remains in the hand of the priest shall then be put on the lobe of the right ear of him who is to be cleansed, and on the thumb of his right hand, and on the big toe of his right foot, and on top of the blood of the guilt offering. So now there is a covering of all the places where the blood was put, but now with oil. The oil that he had sprinkled before God, he is now symbolically also layering on the ear, the thumb, and the toe of this person. It's almost like he's been painted with blood and now with oil in these locations. And oil is now put on the actual offering itself as well. And the rest of the oil that's in the priest's hand, he shall put on the head of him who is to be cleansed. And now we're going to pour the rest of what's left on your head. The priest shall offer the sin offering to make atonement for him. What does atonement mean? Sorry? No, that's something else, but that's more of a propitiation, perhaps. Atonement just means to cover. All right? To cover what in this case? Was it sinful to have leprosy? What are we doing between here? What status are we changing? Covering the uncleanness. Right? We're changing that uncleanness to becoming clean. To now being able to approach God. I hope that as we talk through these things, there will be some questions in the back of your mind as you think about your own relationship with God and how we approach God and how Christ has dealt with not just our sin, but our status with God and our uncleanness to now being clean, being able to approach God. What are we washed with? Okay, we're washed in the blood of Christ. You'll have to find a verse for me that says that. What does the Bible normally talk about being washed with? Not the word. Water. All right? That was one of the elementary things in Hebrews 6 that they were supposed to learn right off the bat. Our baptism in Romans 6, since it's echoing here, our class in 6, what did that baptism do? All right. We died to that old life through our baptism. We put on Christ, Galatians 3 says. Through the washing of the regeneration, all right, as Titus talks about. And so the washing here is also an element that we need to pay attention to. All right, verse 21. But if he's poor and cannot afford so much, then he shall take 1 male lamb for the guilt offering to be waived and make atonement for him, and 1/10 of an ephah. And I'm not going to go through all that again. But now with a lesser expensive collection of animals here, but through the same process. We already talked about when Jesus was redeemed and Joseph and Mary came to the temple and they did not bring expensive animals. What did they bring? Turtle doves. All right, so we see the dynamic there as well. All right, time-wise, we're going to pass on here. Verse 32 says, "This is the law for him who, in whom is a case of leprous disease who cannot afford the offerings for his cleansing." Okay, so it goes through each of these sections. It introduces it, tells you all the specifications, and then it closes it out, and then it goes to the next category. The next category is your home. Do houses get skin diseases? All right. It gets an infection, right? Right. And so what do we generally refer to those as today? Mildew, what else? Fungus, what else? Sorry? Termites, okay. That would be an animal infestation. This is not animals, but germs, mold is what I was looking for, okay? Black mold. What happens to homes today that have black mold? They try to get it out, but usually they just condemn it and take it all out. And what do they do with that stuff? Do they build other houses with that now? They destroy it, okay? Sometimes they burn it. All right, we're going to find a parallel here. And there's going to be a temptation to think of it in terms of health, but try not to look at it that way. God doesn't specify that this is for health purposes. I want you to see that in His law, He is still stating the difference between clean and unclean, and the effect of a home that is where its boundaries should be, and where it is not, where it becomes unclean. All right. When you come into the land of Canaan, do they have any houses right now? Not a single one. Even the tent of meeting, the most important place of assembly, is a tent. And they're going to be using these for the next 40 years. But eventually, this law is for when they get to Canaan, which I give you for a possession, and put a case of leprous disease in a house in the land of your possession. The next verse says who the onus is on, just like it is with that person themselves. Whose responsibility is it to say there's a problem? The homeowner, the person that lives there, the person that sees that. Likewise with yourself. It wasn't the priest's job to go around and check people's homes. But it was their job when somebody said, "I think I got a problem with my house." Then they were to follow this set of rules. The priest shall command that they empty the house before the priest goes in to examine, lest all that is in the house be declared unclean. And he shall examine. And if it's in the walls of the house with greenish or reddish spots, if it appears to be deeper than the surface, the priest will go out the house of the door and shut up the house 7 days. Lock it up. Can't stay here. Go stay with relatives. After 7 days, you hear the echo of the same type of thing with the person. Don't touch anybody. Wait 7 days and see if it spreads. If it does, then we got a problem. Now you're unclean. Now you need to be outside of the camp. Well, you can't necessarily move a house outside of the camp. What's the remedy here? It depends on the situation, right? If it's spreading, then you're supposed to remove the stones that make up this infection of the house and then do another what? Wait some more and see if that got rid of the problem. If it didn't, then the whole house goes. And where are you supposed to put all these infected stones? In an unclean place outside of the city. So each city had to designate a place that was not clean. Outside of Jerusalem, this was called Gehenna, which is the picture that Jesus uses in describing hell, because the trash was always there burning, stinking up the place, and it was an unclean place. It was a way it could never approach the holy. All right. Running out of time, and I want to get to chapter 15 as well. Chapter 15. Chapter 15 is in the Scriptures just as much as chapter 14. And so without putting too fine a point on it, we're going to talk about it as well. And we're adults. And if you, as parents, feel a little squeamish about your kids hearing about this subject, I don't see any kids in here, but in the past, this subject has even been considered taboo, depending on how close to Victorian sexual ethics you have become. But I want you to see that God never deals with the subject of sex in an unclean manner, as we have historically used the term, or an unholy manner, as if there's something wrong with it. I've labored so far to help us see that it's not a case of moralness, whether something is unclean or clean, but how we deal with it. How God outlines to deal with it through the Israelites that determined their availability to approach Him in holiness. And so just as it was with Wednesday night when we spoke about the menstrual cycle or childbirth, we're now going to talk about procreation in the potential sense. Because procreation, whether it's having the proper sexual relation inside the marriage, or whether it results in childbirth to God, that was not going to be in the category of clean, but of unclean, as it related ceremonially to approaching Him. And so there's two categories for men and two categories for women, and they both involve the idea of reproduction, where the bodily fluids that it takes for this to happen, either the normal way or abnormal way for both males and females, had different requirements in order to come back into a state of being clean, and therefore in a state where you could ceremonially approach God as well. And it's dealt with chiastically, so we're going to talk about the abnormal way for males first, and then the normal way for males, the normal reproductive ways for females, and then abnormal or out of the ordinary, or there's something wrong, something's not working right. And all of these categories have the same result. They make you unclean as it relates to approaching God. Not morally, again. This is just talking about ceremonially, place-wise, location-wise. And so the category, if you had something wrong down here, that was causing a discharge, something that was not normally happening, or it was causing all kinds of, I don't know, perhaps symptoms of a venereal disease or whatever is going on, the priest had the unfortunate task of examining that. And if that was the case, then you were considered unclean for how long? I want you to start seeing this pattern here develop. Starting in verse, it's not just his body that is becoming unclean, but everything that body touches. All right, his clothes that he was wearing, the bed he was laying on, the person he touched. Anybody who touches his bed shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. So to a lesser degree, anybody that touches him or his clothes or his bed, they're unclean as well. But the person themselves, who has this continuing problem, I had to laugh at verse 8, if that person who is unclean spits at you, that makes you unclean. All right? So if you get anything from him directly, physically, then you yourself will be unclean. All right. So So for as long as this problem persists, he remains unclean. If it's in the normal, everyday sense, even in Deuteronomy where it talks about soldiers who are out in the field away from their wives, away from women, and where that ability to procreate builds up in their system and there's a natural way for that to be expelled at night, and they wake up the next morning and realize, oh, I had a nocturnal emission. That made them unclean as well. And they couldn't even fight that day. They had to leave the camp for the day, wash, and then come back that evening to be clean. And so even procreation in the normal sense of the word, in the good sense of the word, be fruitful and multiply, those were all good things, but it made you ceremonially unclean and not appropriate to approach God according to the law of Moses until that was taken care of that evening. All right, so verse 12, I think, is also interesting. The earthenware vessel that the one with the discharge touches shall be broken, and every vessel of wood shall be rinsed with water. So clothes you need to wash. If it was a wooden implement, it needed to be scrubbed with water. But if it was pottery, I don't know whether it was the porous nature of pottery, but every time you hear pottery involved in being unclean, the result is that it had to be broken, not used anymore, thrown into the unclean place outside of the city. All right, bathed his body in fresh water and shall be clean. On the eighth day, we see the same type of deal again. Two pigeons come before the Lord at the entrance of the meeting, give them to the priest. The priest shall use them, one for a sin offering. The priest shall make atonement for him for the Lord for his discharge. Okay, the discharge was not sinful. Remember, this atonement is not for sin. It's for being ceremonially unclean. So verse 18 talks about the normal husband and wife relation. And if that's the case, and there's an ejaculation, then both the wife and the husband are unclean until that evening. And they both have the same remedy, to wash and wait till that evening the next day, and then they will be ceremonially clean. And verse 19 then flips. Instead of talking about males, it talks about females. Females also have an important part to the reproductive system that involves bodily fluids leaving the body. And so if that woman is not creating life, the normal thing is for her to get rid of all that every month. And that cycle, which was a normal, regular, God-created, God-approved way of doing it, also ceremonially made them unclean. And perhaps because it was blood, blood has a special place, and I'm not trying to say it is. But in this case, that flow was for usually a week or so, and they had to physically leave and go outside of the camp. And so, statistics-wise, I want you to think about this for a moment. If this happens for a week at a time, and there's 4 weeks every month, at any given time, you're going to have a quarter of the population of women outside of the camp, waiting for their menstrual cycle to end before they come back. That's an interesting dynamic to think of that we don't have to live through today. But I want you to see the importance to God that ceremonially, when we approach Him, it's very important. And that even normal, everyday things that we are required, that come upon us, sometimes by not even our own choices, that there are things that we do, if we were Israelites, to make it so that we could approach God physically on this earth in the location in which He determines is holy. And it goes through the description. Anything that she touches, anything that is a problem, just like with the males, she touches anything, the bed that she's been lying in becomes unclean as well, and that has to be ceremonially taken care of. And then the category is where it's not just your regular monthly flow. Now it's at a different time that's unexpected and is not necessarily related to your normal monthly cycle, but you've got an issue of blood. Can you think of somebody in the New Testament that had this problem? How long did she have it for? 12 years? It was a long time, right? And she had spent all of her wealth trying to take care of it. And she was desperate. What condition did she remain in for her adult life while this was going on? Unclean. And everything that she touched became unclean. And everybody that she touched. So guess what? How many people wanted to come up and give her a hug? Now that didn't make this person persona non grata. But it didn't affect their relationship with God. They were still good with God. But even the Israelites had difficulty associating the difference between being ceremonially unclean and being morally good with God. And we need to be careful that we don't make the same mistake as well. All right, so even if you're the husband and you wake up and your wife just bled on the sheets, guess what? You're now unclean as well for the rest of the day. And so all these things that are no longer in the body where God designed them to be, protected by your skin, anytime that boundary has been breached, there is ceremonially a way for that to be taken care of. All right, and again, it takes time, and it takes animals to help ceremonially make that right again. Look at verse 13, since we only have a moment left. Verse 31. Chapter 15, verse 31. This is the sum up here. Thus you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in their midst. God was physically in their midst. And no matter what the reason was, if you found yourself unclean and breached this decorum and went to a place that was designated as holy, where God was going to react violently. As we saw with Nadab and Abihu. So these laws, these rules, were to help the Israelites do the right thing and at the same time teach them the significance of making sure that when you approached God, it was with reverence and honor that he deserves. All right, guys, chapter 16, when Philip returns, and please thank him for me that he didn't have to teach this section.